Welcome to the Power Hour. I'm Adrienne Herbert, wellness coach, international speaker, and author. Each week, I speak to a variety of guests, from business founders to Olympic athletes, leading coaches, change makers, and innovators, to find out their daily habits, their rules to live by, and what motivates them to get up out of bed each day. Personally, I am on a mission to encourage, motivate, and inspire, so I hope that the Power Hour will help you to achieve your personal and professional goals. Welcome back to the Power Hour podcast. Today, I am joined by Dale Pinnock. Dale is a nutritionist who has dedicated 26 years of his life to studying the science and application of nutrition. He is a Sunday Times best-selling author and has published an impressive 18 books. Dale has so much knowledge and he is on a mission to bring accessible and understandable info about nutrition to all of us so that we can all take control of our own health. Welcome to the podcast. Dale, how are you doing?
I'm very well. How are you?
I'm really well, thank you. And I mean, I probably say this every week, like, oh, I can't wait for this conversation. But honestly, as somebody who kind of geeks out quite a lot on different things when it comes to nutrition, I'm really excited to talk to you.
Oh, fantastic. Oh, you know what? I'm like that too. I mean, you kind of, it's one of those subjects where you can just go down the rabbit hole and just get more and more excited and more questions. The more answers you get, the more questions seem to pop up and you just get further and further into it.
Absolutely. And of course, before, I suppose a caveat for this whole conversation is that today, you know, you are a nutritionist. We're going to be talking about the science. We're going to probably be going quite granular on some of these things. And it kind of goes without saying that there's so much to it when it comes to food, when it comes to what we eat, how we eat, the emotional side of it, the social side of it, you know, economic factors, all of that. But for the purpose of today, I really want to focus on, yeah, the science and the information and the detail, because it is overwhelming and confusing for people, let's be honest. You know, there's so much information and it changes all the time, it seems, about what we should eat, when we should eat, how much we should eat, foods that boost gut health, foods that boost brain health, foods that, you know, debating about carbs, fats, protein, plant-based, paleo, fasting, like, come on, it just goes on and on and on. Oh. And so it's no wonder people feel a little bit like, oh my gosh, where do we start?
Yeah, it's bizarre how this all happened. I mean, like I say, it's this year, it's 30 years that I've actually been in the nutrition industry, which I need to update my bio. It's crazy when I think about that. I always knew that it was going to get big. I always knew that, like, once people cottoned on to the realization that the way that you eat has a huge influence on a multitude of different health outcomes, that it was going to get big. What I never saw coming, though, was how nutrition was going to get intertwined with popular culture. I mean, I never thought in a million years kale would be aspirational, but it has. It's become like entwined with popular culture, and with that comes fad and fashion, with that comes misinformation, with that comes little half-truths that get repeated over and over again, and that's what leads to the confusion. When you actually take a step back from that and look at the evidence base, look at the totality of the evidence, then it is possible to actually get some clarity in terms of what's the better approaches to take without getting kind of caught up in all that minutiae.
Yeah, well, you're very good at doing that. You know, someone who follows you online, you know, when I watch your videos, you're very clear at doing that. And it's not so much myth busting, but it's actually, yeah, providing the facts. And so for today's conversation, I've kind of picked out three topics that I wanted to dive in on, because otherwise we could talk about everything. So the topics that I've chosen are protein, sugar, and gut health. And I think that's just because in the wellness world, in the fitness world, I feel like there's a lot of conversation, debate, misinformation, etc. So hopefully we can just find out some of the truth, some of the myths, and really just focus on what's important. So first up, let's start with protein. Now, yes. As I mentioned, I've worked in the health and wellness industry for 10 years, and it seems like our focus on protein has just increased every single year. I feel like, to be honest, the fitness industry is pretty obsessed with protein, and that's kind of gone more into mainstream. You know, you can see protein now written on Mars bars. There's a protein Mars bar. Did you know that?
I have seen that, yeah. I mean, I think it's a bit of a push, but yeah.
Yeah, and there's recipes for protein pancakes, protein banana, all these things. Yeah. So I've also heard a lot of conflicting advice about, you know, and some of these industry experts are people that I know and respect. So I'm kind of torn between, okay, is this right? So I guess for someone who maybe exercises 3 to 4 times a week, typically they're pretty active and they enjoy exercise, whatever that is, maybe that's going to the gym or running or swimming, whatever it is. How much does, I guess, firstly, protein impact our performance, our recovery and our longevity?
It's hugely important for recovery from a workout, obviously, because especially if you're doing sort of quite heavy resistance work, because you're actually breaking down that muscle tissue and you require a huge amount of protein to actually help it to repair and to build. I mean, if you're trying to build muscle, then you need to be in that positive nitrogen balance. In terms of how much we actually need, that's a really sliding scale. If someone is very, very active, the old school kind of recommendation is like 1 gram of protein for every pound of body weight. I mean, that's the kind of old school bodybuilding type approach. But really, I don't think many of us, unless you're an elite athlete, need to worry that much. What I will say to people is just try and get some good quality protein in each meal. I mean, that has a lot of benefits way beyond just the exercise recovery. I mean, you can look at protein in two ways. I mean, the first way of looking at it is if you're worried about protein deficiency, it is virtually impossible, unless you do something really bizarre like live on one bowl of rice a day, to get into that state of protein energy malnutrition, which manifests itself as a condition called kwashiorkor, which you sometimes see in populations where there is a high level of starvation. You'll see like the kids with the bloated bellies. You often see those kind of pictures on some of these charity campaigns. That kwashiorkor, that is actual true protein energy malnutrition. In the Western world, that ain't going to happen. A lot of people worry about protein when they're eating plant-based diets, for example. Our protein is made out of many different amino acids. Our protein's like a brick wall, okay? And the individual bricks are the amino acids. Different proteins use different amino acids in different sequences. Whenever we eat any protein, we break it down into the individual amino acids. Those amino acids go to the liver and sit in the amino acid pool. And then when we need a specific protein to be synthesized or created, our liver does that. It just knits together the sequence of amino acids that are unique to that protein, and off it goes. As long as you're eating a varied diet, you'll be getting the full cross-section of the amino acids. So that's the first thing to think about with protein. You will never be deficient in it. Okay.
To be honest, that's what I was kind of getting at there, because as we know, there's a lot of, you know, protein shakes, protein bars, like add these things to your diet. And sometimes I've heard people similar to what you're saying say, well, actually, if you eat, you know, if you look at your diet throughout the week, if you're eating eggs, if you're eating nuts, if you're eating chicken, you're not going to be protein deficient. Don't worry about it. And then there's other people saying, no, after every single run or after every single workout, you must within 45 minute window eat a high protein snack or a high protein drink to replenish your, and it's kind of this very polarizing thing of saying, well, actually, do you need to do this, or why are people saying within this window straight after training you've got to have protein? What's that about?
Well, it is that recovery window. I mean, that's a very, very different sort of argument to general day-to-day health. When you're very active, and if you're trying to achieve specific athletic goals, then it's a completely different rule book. Certainly protein within that recovery window is going to help you to recover more effectively from that workout. But on a day-to-day level, I always encourage people, because one of my big areas of interest is metabolic health. If you look around, certainly before COVID, the main things that were burdening the healthcare system were type 2 diabetes, were obesity, and cardiovascular disease. Those three very closely linked issues are all related to metabolic health. So in general, in this country, we are in a poor state of metabolic health. So one of the things that I always encourage people to do is at every single meal, make sure you've got a good quality protein on your plate. And this has got nothing to do with exercise recovery or anything like that. This is all about supporting good metabolic health. And the reason behind that is, if you look at your plate at each meal, if you imagine breakfast, lunch, dinner, you've got a really good quality protein like eggs or fish, or if you're plant-based, it could be tofu or tempeh or something like that. You've also got a really good quality, slow-burning, high-fiber carbohydrate, so think brown rice or sweet potato or quinoa or something like that. And then also you've got an abundance of non-starchy vegetables. When you compose meals like that, that has a huge impact upon multiple markers of metabolic health. It slows the rising of blood sugar down. It keeps you feeling fuller for longer. It actually increases the production of satiety hormones. It ticks lots of boxes. So I always say to people, every meal, just make sure there's a good quality protein there. And that's as much as you need to worry about.
Yeah, and I suppose, as you said, it's very important to recognise that it's not one size fits all. And so for some people, if they are obese, if they're inactive, you know, of course, the suggestion for somebody like that to change their maybe diet habits or their daily routines is going to be very different to probably someone like myself or some of the listeners of the show who are endurance athletes, you know, people that are training for, you know, ultra races or even like I say, people who are very active. They might do CrossFit 3 times a week or, you know, so it's very, very different. They're not, you know, they're not the same thing of saying, okay, I want to reduce my sugar intake and trying to get my 10,000 steps. It's actually people that are saying, they're already healthy and they want to get healthier or they want to optimize. And so one thing, I guess, looping back to this metabolic health, something I have heard a lot about is metabolic flexibility. Now, I don't know whether this is, like, again, I don't know whether this is truth, whether this is myth, but what I've learned about this is essentially that our body needs to be able to adapt to different stresses and different, food sources and fuel sources. Mm-hmm. So, for example, having low carb foods for a few days versus having, or should reverse that, having loads and loads of carbs before you're going to do an endurance event, and other times having high fats, high proteins, and basically saying that your body can flip between, I don't know if this is the right vernacular, but what it wants to use as fuel. Like, are we using sugar? Are we using fats? Are we using carbs? So is metabolic flexibility, firstly, true? Is it possible? Is it something that we should be aiming for? What is metabolic flexibility?
So metabolic flexibility is, as you rightly say, the ability for the body to either use glucose or ketone bodies depending on the metabolic environment within a given moment. How effectively we do that can have a huge impact upon things like blood lipid levels, upon our ability to manage our weight effectively. So it's quite an important thing to keep that response healthy. It's hardwired into our DNA. So if you think about it, when we were hunter-gatherers for the biggest chunk of human evolution, when we were actually living like wild mammals rather than the ridiculous kind of way of living that we've built for ourselves now, when we were living like that, we would have times of feast and famine. We would have times when food was really, really scarce. We have an incredible ability to be able to store different types of fuel. So we can store fat and we can store glucose. We store glucose in the form of glycogen, which we store in the liver and within the skeletal muscle. And then also, as we all know very well, we can store, if there's an excess of glucose, you can turn that glucose into triglycerides, which are then stored in the adipose tissue. When we had those times of famine, prolonged period, not true famine necessarily, but prolonged periods of time without eating because we had to go and find our own food, what happens is for the first 25, 30 minutes or so, you'll start to run on the stored glucose. So you'll be using your glycogen. Then after a while, blood glucose drops and drops and drops and drops, and there's nothing else available. So the body has to start releasing the stored triglycerides from the adipose tissue, from the fat cells. It actually starts to release those triglycerides and we actually burn those, and we turn those into things called ketone bodies that we can use in place of glucose. Now, that only happens in two ways. There's two ways of making that happen in your body. Intermittent fasting will do that. So I'm quite a fan of intermittent fasting. Yeah. And also a ketogenic diet. The thing with a ketogenic diet, it's incredibly effective for multiple elements of metabolic health, but it's really, really easy to cock it up. And if you get it wrong, it can be one of the most unhealthy things you could possibly do to yourself, because it is so precise. You're either in ketosis or you're not. Even if there's the slightest deviation in terms of, like, I mean, there might be a little bit of hidden sugar in a dressing that you're using or something like that, that's enough to knock you out of ketosis, and then the sheer amount of fat there can start to cause problems. So the easiest way to kind of kickstart the production of those ketones is the intermittent fasting. If you couple that with a low carbohydrate diet, then you'll be moving in the right direction. And then after, what I do is I do about 3 months on, 3 months off.
Oh, so that long? Okay.
Yeah. I'm sort of doing the keto thing at the minute. I feel amazing on it, but it's to get that metabolic flexibility. But when I do bring the carbohydrates back in, I always combine them with the proteins as well, just to make sure that I don't get the blood sugar peaks and troughs. When we have that metabolic flexibility, it means that we can use either fuel source effectively, and that does have a huge knock-on effect on our long-term metabolic health. Because one of my absolute bugbears, right, but the thing that drives me crazy is this whole idea of like, oh, calories in, calories out, la la la. It's just such nonsense. It's so misguided. The whole thing of like, you know, eat less, move more. Are you mad? You know, this whole thing of like, oh, you're only gaining weight because you're eating more calories than you're burning. It's like, well, we're not a combustion engine. We are a biological system that absorbs, that metabolizes, that excretes, that is self-regulating using hormones, like upregulating and downregulating hormones. It's a completely different kettle of fish. Your body will respond to the type of fuel that's present. Okay, so you could still be within this quote unquote calorie deficit, but if you're eating loads and loads of refined carbohydrates and you're flooding your blood sugar, you're still going to store fat.
This is so fascinating. I think a couple of things that stood out to me. One is about scarcity. You know, as you described quite briefly, we used to have these periods of scarcity, I guess. I don't know how many hundreds of years ago. Mm-hmm. But our lifestyle now, for the majority of people, we're very fortunate. We do not have to go through scarcity, therefore, sure, i.e. going without fasting. So I think where intermittent fasting has become, again, it's become maybe a trend or popular. And it, again, it's quite divisive, actually. I've also heard people saying, you know, women shouldn't do intermittent fasting and it's bad for our hormones and for endurance runners, etc., versus this kind of biological, even if you go back to, you know, biblical texts, even back to Bible times, you know, all these different religions that have periods of fasting. Yes, it's for spiritual and it's for different reasons other than just the body, but there's always been a practice of deprivation, and what comes with that, I think, is good for both the mind and the body. So it's really interesting, that fact that you said, basically, because we don't have it anymore, we have to create it for ourselves. And I think sometimes people don't like that because it's, you know, we don't like to do difficult things. And let's be honest, we're busy people. And, you know, when you get hungry in the afternoon or in the morning, for example, you know, skipping breakfast or, you know, it's not always the thing you want to do. But I like to always think about, you know, longevity, future self, and kind of thinking, yeah, actually, if biologically this is going to be beneficial for me to do something like this, maybe. I didn't realize, actually, as well, when you said 3 months, I thought it was more like, oh, you do it for a week or you do it for 4 days or whatever. So
you can do whatever you want, whatever works for you. It's just, I'm just a like self-flagellation maybe, but like, you know, I just like to do it like that. You know what? There's something in, I just picked up on something you said there about doing things that are difficult. Now, I really love people like David Goggins and Tom Bilyeu, and one of the things that they always say is like, do something that sucks every day.
Oh, you're speaking just, my language, Dale. Yeah, people on this show know me for you can do hard things. Yeah. Doing hard things is beneficial to all of us and it's necessary. I'm totally with you.
I do think that like, we need to kind of practice that mental toughness a little bit and put ourselves through some of these things so that we can cope with the madness that's going on out there.
Before we, because we could definitely go down the rabbit hole of keto and all of that, but I'm not going to go there. I think what I would like to do, as I mentioned at the start, I was going to talk about protein, sugar, and gut health. Hopefully we'll get through them all. Now, sugar, wow, this is a big one. This is a big one, especially for me. You know, Jamaican heritage, people like to joke, oh, we've got a sweet tooth, but, you know, sugar is a vice for me.
Sugar cane.
Oh, yes. And we've all probably heard that sugar is bad for our teeth. It's bad for energy management. We've been told it's bad for our skin. It's bad for our waistline. I've even heard sugar being referred to as poison for the body, which is pretty terrifying for someone who loves sugar, but also maybe true. And it's also described, as we know, as being highly addictive. So when it comes to sugar, Dale, just tell me the truth. Is it really all bad news?
There's a great quote that I think sums this up perfectly. The difference between poison and medicine is the dose. Okay.
Ooh, okay.
And it's literally, it all depends on how much you're eating. A little bit of sugar now and again ain't going to kill you. It's not going to do anything negative. The thing is, it's the sheer amount that is sneaking into our day-to-day diet. And this isn't just the obvious stuff, like a chocolate bar or fizzy drink or stuff like that. We're talking in our sauces and dressings and even the simple carbohydrates, white bread, white rice, white pasta, that kind of stuff. That's basically just sugar because there's no fiber there. There's a huge glucose load within those kind of foods. Takes very little digestive effort to liberate that glucose, and it's no different from eating a great big chocolate bar. So when we're consuming the levels that we are, that's when it starts to become problematic. That's when the amount of damage that it can do, yes, of course, it can drive weight gain, because one of the things that I was talking about earlier, if there is too much sugar in your bloodstream, the first thing that happens when you consume some sugar, your blood sugar rises. When blood sugar rises, the body responds to that by releasing the hormone insulin. Insulin binds to an insulin receptor in our cells. It opens a little doorway in the cell called the glucose transporter. That glucose starts to go in, and the cell uses that glucose as energy. All good. Cells can only use so much in one sitting. Okay, so once they've got enough, once they've taken in as much as they can, they shut the doors. And if blood sugar is still really, really high, which it will be from those kinds of foods, then it's a state that's potentially life-threatening, so it needs to be dealt with. The next thing that will happen is that we'll actually start to store some within the skeletal muscle and the liver in the form of glycogen. But then if there's still an excess of sugar at this point, it has to be dealt with. It has to be gotten out of the way. So it gets sent to the liver and converted into something called triglycerides. Triglycerides, these are a fatty substance that gets stored in the adipose tissue. So yes, you start to put on weight, but also those triglycerides have to be sent to the fat tissue via the cardiovascular system. So your blood fats start to go up, which means your LDL cholesterol, the damaging cholesterol, starts to go up. Your blood triglycerides go up. These can oxidize, which causes damage to the cardiovascular system. So already you're increasing your risk of cardiovascular disease. You're putting on weight. But if you're constantly flooding your body with sugar day in, day out, and you're constantly pushing insulin up all the time, the receptors that detect insulin will eventually start to become a little bit deaf to the insulin signal. It'll be like the boy that cried wolf. They'll be like, hang on, I think insulin's maybe lost its mind a little bit, so I'm just going to ignore it. There's definitely something going on. So we move into a state that's called insulin resistance. At that stage, we become less effective at dealing with the excess sugar. That can start to become very, very toxic and then damage the pancreas, and we have type 2 diabetes. So already you look at the disease patterns that are within the Western world, like the UK, the US, most of Western Europe, you'll see those disease patterns, and it's all to do with that excess sugar. That's why there's so much type 2 diabetes, there's so much obesity, there's so much cardiovascular disease, because that flood of sugar is causing so many detrimental problems.
Yes, it really is. And I think a couple of things to note there about, you know, when you said white bread or pasta and saying, you know, obviously it's not necessarily the same as maybe, we don't view it in the same way as a bag of sugary pick and mix. But actually, I think, exactly. So this is the thing. It's that misinformation, isn't it? Of people thinking, oh, I'm having pasta or I'm having toast but like having white refined carbohydrates is obviously very, very high in sugar. Mm-hmm. And so I guess, what are the differences between, because it's not, all sugar's not created equal, right? So what is the difference between fructose, for example, if you're having berries or citrus fruits or maybe even dates, compared to when you're having refined sugar, for example, in biscuits and cakes? Because I think that's also, as a parent, I know, you know, my son's 10 now, but a lot of my friends are now having babies, weaning, you know, different ages and stages, and often they'll think, oh, I'm not going to let them have those, I don't know, those biscuits or crackers, they're full of sugar, but they'll have loads and loads of berries and raisins and is that the same, or is it better? What's the difference there?
When you actually take the individual sugar itself, sugar is sugar is sugar. I mean, they've got slightly different structures. The thing that makes the difference is how the sugar is packaged. Okay, so the reason that things like the white bread and the white pastas are as bad as they are is because there's very little fiber in there. So that means the glucose that's present gets released very, very quickly. When you're looking at fruits and vegetables, they contain a lot of fiber. So yeah, there's quite a large amount of sugar in there, but because of the fiber, it takes a while to actually liberate that sugar. So it's going to have more of a drip feeding effect on your blood sugar. And that's the issue. It's not the sugar itself. It's how much there is, how rapidly it gets into your bloodstream, and then the knock-on effect that has on different hormones and metabolic markers. But you get, if people are into juicing, I mean, I find this if I drink a fruit juice. So if it, like, literally straight through the juicer. So if I had, like, you know, apple and orange or something like that, if I drank that, I'd get really lightheaded and feel like I'm really spinning out. If I ate the apple and ate the orange, I wouldn't, because the fiber slows down the release of the sugar. And that's the difference. I mean, you know, people say, like, natural sugar and unnatural sugar. I mean, there's not really any difference. The difference is the food that it's actually within, and it's all to do with the fiber.
Right. Okay, great. Because also, of course, you know, before anybody comes at me saying, you know, oh, you of course you're going to give fruit to kids, it's good for them. Yes, I'm not going to, you know, negate that. Of course, having a variety of foods, fruits, vegetables, different things in your diet, of course. And also, yeah, the vitamins, minerals, all the things we get from having blueberries and oranges, of course, is brilliant. I think the reason I bring it up is just because I think, especially for young children, like, everything they're eating sometimes can be sugar, you know, even if you, so I think it's just being mindful and having that awareness that, okay, if they're having a bowl of fruit with breakfast, if they're having, I don't know, jam on toast, if they're having something sweet, then throughout the day, they're probably having a lot of sugar, regardless of whether it's just from biscuits or whether it's from fruit. It's the overall amount that I think is probably very high.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly that. And you know what? There are ways to negate this. I think this is just an important little caveat to add. And it comes down to protein again. We were talking about protein earlier. If, say, for, you know, and I'm fully aware that there's a huge amount of financial pressure on people at the moment. Mm-hmm. And it's not always easy. You can have the best will in the world, but it's not always easy to get healthier choices in certain situations. If the only thing that you've got access to is white bread, then if you've got a good amount of protein with it, the presence of the protein will slow down the release of the glucose, so it's less of an issue. If you've got the white refined pasta, then add some protein with it, some chicken, some tuna, some cheese, anything like that. That will slow down the release of the glucose. So you can buffer it. You can take steps to improve it. The ideal scenario, of course, is go for the multigrain, go for as much fiber and as much of the good stuff as you can. But I don't want to kind of sound like I'm in an ivory tower. I understand that there are issues and there's stuff going on, but you can take steps to actually make it as good as you possibly can.
Yeah, absolutely, because you're right, you know, cost of living is going up. It's very difficult for, you know, people's circumstances are completely different when it comes to what they can afford, access, education. And also, as well, I'll be honest, again, I don't want to keep going on about parents, but a lot of my friends, it's with all the will in the world, they've got fussy eaters. So that's another thing, which again, we could do a whole show on that. But when you're saying, you know, for some friends of mine, they're like, look, at the moment, hopefully it's just a phase. But one friend in particular, her son, I mean, he probably eats four or five things. He's only a little, he's only three, but she's just constantly like, oh my goodness, you know, he's going to be, she thinks he's going to be, you know, really malnourished and this and that. And I'm kind of assuring her, look, it won't last forever. But there's also these different challenges of trying to get your kids to try different foods and eat different things when often they're like, no, don't like that, don't want to eat that.
This was a real recurrent theme on the TV show that I'm on, Eat Shop Save. We were working with families and nearly every episode we would have a fussy eater.
Right.
What I will say, I mean, there's two ways that you can really improve the situation. One, actually getting them involved in cooking, and when they've got an emotional investment in the food, that can sometimes make them a little more adventurous. Or if all else fails, ethical hoodwinking, which is basically hiding as much as you can. So I always show people my hidden veg sauce. Yeah. So if the kids will eat pasta and tomato sauce, then you're onto a winner. So you just get red onion, garlic, peppers, courgettes, spinach, as much veg as you could possibly put together, saute it till it's nice and soft, put a couple of tins of tomatoes in there, and then puree it all up. Just get the stick blender in there and blend it. Looks, smells, tastes, feels like a regular tomato sauce. You stir that through the pasta, they won't know.
Oh my God, absolutely. You know what, again, I can attest to this because I used to do exactly that. I used to make two different pasta sauces. One was red, and it, as you described, you know, carrots, onion, tomato, and the other was green, and you just call it the Hulk pasta. Mm. It was like a pesto pasta, but essentially I made it and I would put loads of spinach, loads of peas, broccoli, garlic, you know, blend it up. It looked the same as normal pesto out of the jar, and that was actually my trick for years of getting my son to eat different vegetables.
Love it.
Yeah, okay, so last thing on sugar, because we both actually worked with Graze recently. So we worked with a brand called Graze on their no added sugar campaign. And that was pretty eye-opening. You know, it highlighted added sugar, and I think, and, you know, in quotation. And I think, again, this is often a problem that people just are not aware of. They think they're making a healthy choice, whether that's a snack food or a cereal brand or something they're eating, which they think, okay, this is a healthy choice, you know, again, in quotes. But the problem with added sugar is that we might not recognize that it's there. And you know, I'm all for having information to make the right choice. At the end of the day, if I want to eat an ice cream, I'm going to eat an ice cream. I don't expect it to be a banana. I'm thinking, this is, you know, delicious. I want to have an ice cream. I know it's got sugar in it, but I don't care. I want to eat it. Enough.
Right.
But if I'm eating a banana, I want it to be a banana. Do you know what I mean? So what do you think we need to be aware of when it comes to spotting added sugar?
Understanding how to read labels more effectively. An ingredients list, really looking at the ingredients list, because sometimes these things are given very, very complex names. And you could see things in there that you wouldn't necessarily automatically think are sugars. So understanding that. But then when you look at the nutrition label and you look at the carbohydrate content, you'll see carbohydrate, then you'll see of which sugars. That will tell you a lot. If that's very, very high, if say there's 25 grams of carbohydrate, if it says of which sugars 20 grams, then that's a massive percentage of added sugar.
Okay.
So though it's those kinds of things. The problem is there's not actually any rules for food manufacturers to actually declare how much added sugar is in the food. Which I can see that changing. I can see that with some of the new legislation that's starting to come in terms of like some of the food promotions and where things are in stores and all of that that's coming over the next couple of years. I can see that changing. But because there's not that rule for food manufacturers to actually put it on the packaging, it's very difficult for the consumer to make that healthy choice, like you rightly said. But if you look at the label, and that's the real key, look at the label, look at the carbohydrate content of which sugars. If that's very, very high in comparison to the total carbohydrate number, then you know that there's a lot of added sugar in there.
Yeah, okay. And as I said, you know, we both worked with Graze on this. They did huge amounts of research. I was so impressed when I kind of dived into all of the information in there. It was super useful. So definitely recommend that people find out more about that campaign, No Added Sugar.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
So next up, gut health. As I mentioned, I do feel like there's so much we could do an hour on gut health, but I'm going to make some assumptions about our listeners today. I'm going to make some assumptions that they have probably heard about the gut microbiome. They've probably heard me talk to other guests on the show about having a diverse diet with lots of different plants and, you know, maybe opting for 30 fruits and vegetables a week. But the thing I want to talk to you about, Dale, when it comes to gut health is... Actually, this is from a video that I saw on your Instagram when you were talking about the difference between hormones in the gut and hormones in the brain.
Right.
And so, for example, serotonin, I know, is a big one. People talk about if you have anxiety and depression, then you need to boost your serotonin levels. And I actually Googled which foods boost serotonin. And there's so many things that come up straight away. It says if you want to, the 7 foods that can boost serotonin and 6 ways to boost serotonin without medicine. And it recommends you eat eggs, cheese, turkey, nuts, salmon, etc. And then also it says things like, you know, meditation and getting outside. But the big thing to note here, and actually I'm going to stop talking and put this over to you, is about your serotonin in the gut and serotonin in the brain, and whether that, you know, how what we eat really, you know, what's the chemical, the science between what we eat and what's happening in the brain. So over to you, Dale.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you always hear people say, oh, 70% of the body's serotonin is made in the gut. So if you look, if you've got a healthy gut, you're not going to get depressed. It's like the most ridiculous logic I've ever heard. It's the assumption that if it's present in one place, it's going to have an effect somewhere else. Serotonin is a neurotransmitter that has many functions. Its function is determined by where it is found. So in the gut, serotonin regulates something called peristalsis. This is the rhythmical contraction that moves gut contents along, that pushes things on their journey, right? Serotonin is also active in the skeleton. It's actually involved in bone mineral maintenance. You don't hear people say, oh, look after your skeleton, you won't get depressed. It's also involved in platelet function within the blood. Within the brain, yes, absolutely. It's involved in elevating mood. And also it's the precursor to melatonin, which is involved in sleeping. So its function is determined by where it's found. So yeah, you can increase gut serotonin until the cows come home. That's going to have zero impact on your brain levels of serotonin. If you want to increase your brain levels of serotonin, then a good food source of tryptophan. So tryptophan is an amino acid that is the precursor to serotonin, combined with a relatively fast release sugar. Now this is like, because we were talking about blood sugar spikes earlier. When you're consuming a tryptophan rich food, you want to have a an insulin spike, because the insulin spike actually fires the tryptophan across the blood brain barrier. So that actually helps to improve serotonin production in the brain. If you combine that as well with omega-3 fatty acids, they actually improve serotonin, well, neurotransmitter receptor function. So you're increasing the level of the neurotransmitter and you're making the device that actually listens to its signals work more effectively as well. So you
What's an example of a food that has tryptophan, high in tryptophan?
That's turkey, banana, peanut butter, tuna, all very, very good sources. So one of my favorite things would be something like a tuna open sandwich as a snack, maybe an hour and a half before bed. So if you just like, you know, just a small one, so like a bit of tuna mayo, some spinach, half a slice of bread, knock that back. You've got enough of an insulin spike to actually drive that tryptophan across the blood-brain barrier.
Okay, I'll be honest, I was a little bit gutted when I found this out, this whole thing around you, like you just said, you know, serotonin foods. And because I'm someone who, I think when it comes to low mood, you know, I mentioned earlier about the cycle and like tracking your cycle. And I'm like, okay, cool. What are the things that I can do? I can, you know, override this if I'm having hormonal imbalances, you know, the week before my period, for example, by, you know, eating these foods. And then when I heard you say that, I was like, oh no, it's not true. So, you know, it's kind of like, because also as well, of course, for people who suffer from mental illness, anxiety, depression, etc., I do think sometimes, yeah, it's just put to them, well, do these things, you can kind of, you know, figure it out and improve it for yourself. And that's when I think it's unhelpful, because, you know, of course, some of these conditions, they're not going to change just by that. You, of course, the things you can do to maybe alleviate whatever, but it's not going to change just by, you know, eating a banana.
I mean, diet can have a huge impact on mood. I mean, there's a lot to it. Things like blood sugar balance, things like your fatty acid intakes. I mean, I wrote a book on nutrition, anxiety and depression. So the link is very, very strong. But one of the things that you rightly pointed out, and something that I really want to emphasize as well, is I would view it as part of the therapeutic spectrum. If you've got some serious stuff going on, don't think that just a dietary change is going to get you out of the woods. Get all of the help you need from all directions. Absolutely, get all of the help that you need from all directions. But diet and lifestyle, that represents the one aspect of your healthcare that you can actively engage in. It is that one thing that you can do for yourself. And I guarantee you improve your diet, you will notice a difference in the way that you feel. You absolutely will notice a difference in terms of mood. I mean, a good friend of mine, Dr. Alex Richardson, she was based at Oxford University. She did a lot of research around omega-3 fatty acids and schizophrenia. So nutrition can actually be a tool in some very, very serious issues as well when it's applied in the right way under the right kind of clinical supervision. So it is a powerful tool, but I always emphasize it's part of the therapeutic spectrum. It's not the answer to everything.
Yeah, absolutely. And like you mentioned before, with diets like keto diet, because you know that has, as I'm sure you know, benefits for people with epilepsy, but these are very, very difficult things to stick to as well. The reality is, for somebody who has a you know, maybe a young adolescent with epilepsy, the idea of putting them on a strict ketogenic diet really is going to limit their life as well, in terms of their, not their life, but their lifestyle, you know, being able to have dinner with friends, being able to go to restaurants, being able to have, I don't know, a snack in the afternoon is very, very, very difficult to really stick to as well. So yeah, I agree. I think it's a part of it, but it's not always a simple answer. No. Wow. So much in here. So much, Dale. I could talk to you all day about this, but I'm going to move on to the final segment of the show, which is, of course, the Power Hour. So Power Hour is all about the first hour of your day. I don't really care anymore what time it is. I used to really kind of encourage people to make it super early because there's less distractions going on in the world. You know, you can kind of find the magic of the morning when there's peace and quiet and calm, hopefully. But whatever hour you decide to get up, is there, firstly, your own morning routine? Is there anything you include in the mornings, anything that you avoid in the mornings? And this can be diet or anything else in your lifestyle.
I'm a 5 a.m. person, so I'm always up at 5. I love that time of day. One of the things I always used to do, and certainly I found myself doing it a lot during the pandemic, is I would always, the first thing I would do is put like the morning news on. Now, I completely avoid it because they are just glum whinge trumpets. They're misery klaxons. They are the most, you know, I just cannot listen to this anymore. So now I put some comedy on.
Right.
I'll put some comedy on in the background. I don't even like necessarily pay attention to it. Something really, really silly. I'll make a coffee. I always have like a nice strong coffee, and then just enjoy the coffee. Don't eat. Just sit there and figure out where my day's going. Then on a Sunday, the thing that I love to do on a Sunday, I still get up really early on a Sunday. That time on a Sunday is incredible because nobody's up. And I'm really lucky where I live. My back garden is joined on to like a huge park. And there's a forest that lines all of the outside of this park. So that forest sort of backs onto my back garden. I'll sit out there between 5 and 6 with a coffee, just listening to nature. And it is bliss. No distraction. Yes. And it's just a great way to reset. Then after I've done that for a little while, the next thing that I do is block out my day. I mean, I am relentless with this. I mean, anyone that's tried to get a reply to an email from me knows this. I check my email twice a day. I check it at 9 a.m. and I check it at 3 p.m. If you email me after 3, you're getting dealt with at 9 o'clock the next day. And it's like, because otherwise you end up building your day around other people's agendas and other people's needs. So the next thing that I do in this section of the morning is like, right, I'll block out my day. I'll be like, okay, from 10 till 1, I'm doing content. From 2 till 3, I've got to work on this thing. Like 4 till 5, I've got to get that finished. I'll block out the day. So I actually start the day intentionally. And I use that time for that.
Wow. I mean, you're reading the Power Hour script, if I could have given you one. Because no, honestly, that's what I, you know, it's being intentional. That word is so important. You know, we can just, lives can be busy. We can wake up, go straight into whatever the world demands from us without even having a moment to take a breath or to have a thought of our own. So yeah, I'm a big advocate for being intentional in the morning and taking some time to do whatever you want to do, drinking the coffee, walking the dog, you know, listening to a podcast, whatever it is, but doing something for the first hour, because it really is such a game changer. It can really change how the rest of your day, your week, your month, how you live your entire life. And I know that probably sounds like a extreme, but to say, oh, 1 hour a day can change your life, but it certainly has for me. You know, been doing the Power Hour for 6 years, and I can't tell you, on a day where, for whatever reason, if life happens and things change and I just have to wake up and go straight into something, it throws my entire day not having my first Power Hour. It really is that impactful.
Yeah, it really, really is. Yes, it's just an hour, but if you're using it to really kind of plan how your day, your week, your month or whatever is going, then the knock-on effect that has on multiple elements of your life is really, really quite profound. And it just goes to show that it only takes a small amount of time, an hour in your day, to really create massive change when you do things intentionally, when you actually know which direction you're moving in, when you've got that kind of clarity and structure. I mean, I'm a Virgo, and so I mean, I'm obsessed with like structure and order and everything being kind of spot on, but it makes such a difference. Yeah. It makes such a huge difference.
And for anyone listening who, I guess we've talked a lot about nutrition today, you've given us so much to think about. I'm so grateful for you giving us your time today. If the listeners could take one thing away from this from a nutrition perspective that's going to have the biggest impact on their health and actionable change that they could make, what would that one thing be?
Change one thing. And I don't mean that as like a cop-out answer at all, because it's far from it. What I will say to people is when they're trying to make changes in their diet, so many people try and change everything overnight. They're going to go from like living on beer and pizza to becoming like a raw food yogi overnight. It's like, mate, it's not going to happen. You need to get real. Think of one thing that you know that you could do. So it could be like, make one commitment to yourself. Like, okay, I'm gonna stop snacking on chocolate, and instead I'm gonna snack on fresh fruit. Okay, I'm gonna make sure that with one of my meals I have a good dense side salad. Okay, I'm gonna make sure one of my meals is a home cooked meal. Whatever, pick one thing that you know is realistic, you know that you can actually achieve. Make a commitment to it, and then start doing it. Get your butt in gear. Start doing it. Start acting on it. Just repeat it over and over again. Don't worry about everything else. Just that one thing. That one change, repeat it over and over again. Once that becomes the norm, and once you're kind of like, okay, this is comfortably in my routine, keep doing it, but then pick another thing to change. And then another, and then another. Whilst that might seem like baby steps, when you look back over like 6 or 12 months, that can create some really, really profound lifestyle change. But also, it's done in a very, very comfortable way.
Mm. Yeah. I love that. And as you say, small things day after day after day, it adds up to have a huge, huge impact. I can't believe that it's June, you know, at the start of this year. So many of us, obviously, we have goals, we have aspirations, we have things we want to do. And I think coming out of the pandemic, especially, you know, I run goal setting workshops. So I'm always lucky I get to hear what people want to achieve, what they're working on. And then suddenly I look at the calendar and I'm like, it's June. That means we're halfway through this year. Mm-hmm. So if you're listening to this and you're thinking, oh, gosh, that was me. Yeah, I had some things at the start of this year that I wanted to do. One thing, baby steps. It's okay, because if you keep doing it every day, every week, by the end of this, you've still got 6 more months. What could you achieve in the next 6 months by doing something intentionally, just one thing?
Consistent action. And it also, you know, these consistent improvements. I don't know whether you practice Kaizen. I mean, I lived in Japan for quite a while, and there's one thing in Japanese culture called Kaizen, which is continual improvements and adjustments. You've just got to have some forward momentum. You just have that forward momentum, and then you constantly adjust and tweak and improve. I like to use, you know people always say ready, aim, fire. I like to say ready, fire, aim. So fire, get moving, get going, start doing something, and then figure it out as you go.
Yes, I love
that. Yeah, because the forward momentum is the difference, because far too many people get stuck in analysis paralysis. They think they're overthinking things. They're, you know, they're letting the emotion and the fear and all of these different mental chatter get in the way. But just taking that step, that forward momentum, that's going to actually really, really move you. Who cares if you cock it up? Just adjust. Just keep going and learn forward.
Yes, take this energy. Do not waste it. This is what I love about this show. You know, you never know who's listening, when they're listening. Yeah. And I hope that it will really help people to make a change this week, to feel this energy and this impact, and don't waste it. Awesome. Thank you so much, Dale, for joining us. Is there anything else? Because I know the listeners are probably going to want to know, okay, where can they find you? Where can they find your book? So where can they reach out to you?
My main website is just dalepinnock.com, so PINNOCK.com. Also very active on social. I'm mostly Instagram and Facebook. So Instagram, it's just The Medicinal Chef, and Facebook, The Medicinal Chef. So you can find me on both of those.
Brilliant. Thanks again, and thanks everyone for tuning in, as always. And
ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
For listening to The Power Hour. I'll be back next week. See you.